This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
There we go. Hopefully now you will recognise this map by looking at the geography. I'm sure you will recognise that this is London. And this is a map of London made by the Soviet Union in 1985. If you have a look at some of these details, you'll be able to see and recognise some of these things, I hope. So, obviously, the River Thames is there. The screen's not showing very well, but over here, River Thames, you'll see a couple of arrows. Those arrows are telling you that this is a navigable river and that it's tidal. Give you a sense of some of the detail. If you look at some of the buildings, of course, you'll recognise they're in different colours. Those colours are to show the different classes of buildings. So, some are coloured green for military buildings, like the Horse Guards barracks, for example. Some are coloured purple for the law courts, for administrative buildings, and some are also coloured black for stations, industrial buildings, like Charing Cross Station. You can probably see where that is. Some other detail is shown on this plan as well. The bridge going across to Charing Cross, that's indicated as a metal bridge, for example. Some other bridges, they will tell you the height above water. They'll tell you the material, they'll tell you the carrying capacity in tons of, let's say, tanks going over a bridge. Lots of fascinating details on the map. And if you were to compare it with an Ordnance Survey map of the same time, you wouldn't get that level of classification, certainly in terms of the use of these buildings. Another thing maybe to mention is you might see some of these little symbols. I know this hasn't shown up very well, but little metro symbols, which are the sort of M in a circle, and that will tell you the locations of the underground maps. Accompanying this plan is a little diagram in the top corner of the map that tells you the geographical locations of the tube stations. So rather incredible amount of detail, of course, for these plans and maps that are being made thousands of miles away all across the Soviet Union. And what we have come to understand is that this was a massive project. If you look at London, you might say, well, London was a strategic target. Maybe a lot of the resources, mapping resources, were focused on mapping London. Actually, what you find is that London is only one of about 100 towns and cities that were mapped in this detail across the British Isles. So here's a map that just shows you some of the footprints of where these places are. And of course, again, you might imagine you've got some of the big places like Birmingham. Of course, London is there. Glasgow, their strategic interest because of the port, for example. You've got Newcastle, Edinburgh. But there's also some smaller places as well, like Gainsborough, for example, Pembroke, Dover, that maybe might not have as strategic an interest as you might expect somewhere like London. The story doesn't stop there, though, if we're just looking at some of these maps, because what we have discovered is that this isn't just a European project or a British project, but actually mapping the world. And this summary map here shows you all of the dots that we know of city plans that were, all the cities that were mapped across Europe. And you'll see a lot of these, of course, towards Western Europe, where you think there might be some strategic interest. The different dots are just showing the different scales of map. Most of the maps for cities and towns, around about 1 to 10,000, some at 1 to 25,000. Here's another city, you can probably guess maybe where this is. This is Berlin, another city plan showing some important buildings. The purple ones again, the governmental administrative buildings. You can see the River Spree going through the middle of Berlin. And towards the left, you can see as well a little bit, perhaps, the border between, of course, the Soviet sector and then the different sectors, the British sector, and so on. So not just Britain, not just Europe, but actually the world, and certainly cities, if you think about city, towns and plans, that sort of thing. We're looking at around about 2,000, 2,200 known cities and towns around the world that have been mapped at fairly large scales, so 1 to 5,000 to maybe 1 to 25,000, that sort of scale. So a huge mapping effort going all the way around the world. And you can see here, not only in Europe, although those are the places that we've been able to find most of the maps, but also towards Australia, New Zealand, South America as well. So a massive amount of detail. And this program, we think, was started by Stalin. So during the Cold War, slightly before that, actually, before the end of the Second World War, into the Cold War, to map these foreign towns and cities around the world. So a huge amount of detail. And if you compare, so let's say, the maps that we know of Britain with German mapping that was done prior to the planned invasion, Operation Sea Lion in 1940, you can see actually the Soviet mapping is done at a much more comprehensive level of detail. So rather than just enlarging Ordnance Survey maps, here we have a massive amount of additional detail. So John is now going to talk a little bit more after I'll just show you a couple of examples about that topographic program, a much bigger program. Here's a couple of examples just of cities around the world. Maybe you know where this is, Beijing, for example. You can see the Forbidden City in the middle, somewhere that perhaps you might not have thought the Soviet Union would have got that amount of detail. John will talk a little bit about how the Soviet Union would have done this type of mapping. Maybe you wouldn't guess where this is. This is a map of Tokyo, central Tokyo, from the 1960s, 1966. At a strange scale of 1 to 20,000, usually the specifications are very, very firm. You don't often get deviations, but sometimes you do, and it's quite interesting when you do. You probably guess where this is. New York, and you can see here the Brooklyn Bridge, well, the pointer is reflective rail, the Brooklyn Bridge, and also the Manhattan Bridge. You might notice some numbers that are next to those names, Manhattan and Brooklyn. I can't really show you here very well, just by the bridges. And those will tell you, for example, the material that the bridge is made from, like metal or reinforced concrete, the width of the bridge, the height of the bridge above water in some instances, also, again, the carrying capacity. So a huge amount of detail. And this is Washington. You can probably recognise the strange-shaped building towards the southwest over the Potomac, of course, is the Pentagon. And you can see that coloured in green to indicate that it's a strategic military target as opposed to an industrial or a governmental or administrative building. So John will now talk a little bit about the broader project, give you more idea of the scope.
So Alex has talked about the city plans, which are focused on individual cities. They're one-off sheets, one-off maps of individual cities around the world. But that's only a small part of the Soviet topographic project, a mapping project. And in fact, for the topographic series of maps, pretty well the whole world is mapped at up to 7 different scales. And these maps are based around a grid system, which was first devised in the early 20th century for a proposed international map of the world. That didn't happen, but the Soviets later adopted that system. And the system is a very ingenious and simple one, that the horizontal bands, so at every 4 degrees of latitude, a lettered band. So between latitude 48 and 52 is band M, then they're lettered up from the equator. And the zones are vertical zones between 6 degrees of longitude. So between Greenwich Meridian, which is longitude 0, and 6 degrees east would be zone number 31. So that means that London, where we are, east of Greenwich Meridian, is in square M31. So that simple code, M31, instantly tells us where in the world this map is of. And these maps that for a grid square like that are at 1 to 1 million. So there is the map, M31. 1 to 1 million scale, the western boundary is the Greenwich Meridian, the eastern boundary is 6 degrees east. And that would be classified by the Soviets as no security classification. It's not a secret map, which all the ones that we've looked at previously were classified secret. This is not classified secret, although it would be very restricted in its availability. It's not a secret classification. And its purpose is described as being general terrain evaluation. And so what you can see is not a lot of detail, of course, at that scale, but what you see is the landform. You see the oceans are marked with depths, the main shipping routes are marked, the main land routes are marked, and the landform is clear to see. And there would be one of those, 1 to 1 million maps, for every one of those grid squares where there is land. I guess they didn't do them where it's only ocean. We don't really know that. And the earliest one we have of this, this very sheet, M31, is actually dated 1939. That's quite intriguing, because although we say, well, this project started after the Second World War, 1939 wasn't after the Second World War, so the project maybe had started already. So we do have that tangible evidence, a 1939 sheet of that. Now, for every one of those million squares, there are four at double the scale. So this is the top left-hand corner, the northwest. It's M31-1. So 1, 2, 3, 4 would be the four sheets at 1 to 500,000. Here it is. So we're focusing in now a little bit more, 1 to 500,000. This is dated 1985, and its purpose is described as operational. And so we get a bit more about the land format. We can see the terrain, the contours. We get a lot more information about the shipping routes, and in fact, shipping services and ferries are distinguished, and there's a different symbol for the ferry services across the channel than for the longer haul shipping routes. Towns are indicated, and of course, everything named in Cyrillic, and everything named phonetically in Cyrillic. So the place names, a Russian speaker would look at these maps and would be able to correctly pronounce the place names by reading the Cyrillic. Now, actually, other Warsaw countries were also sharing this mapping, and this is a Polish map. The Poles did not use Cyrillic language, so the Poles have done their own version of this. It's the same map, or a similar map. It's actually dated 1957, this one. The Polish one, 1957. And rather intriguingly, the names are in Polish phonetic. So we get south end on sea, which almost is Cockney phonetic. But that's a Polish version. Anyway, to carry on the story, we've then got the next scale up is 1 to 200,000. There are 36 of these to each million square. So this is M31... 01, it's at the top left of the 36 200,000 series maps to cover square M31. Again, you can see, of course, we're getting more detail because we're getting a larger scale, but also some new information is introduced. And these maps, these 200,000 maps, have purple overprinting of road distances and the dimensions of things like tunnels and bridges. So there it will tell us the length and clearance of the Dartford Tunnel, for example. And major railway and road bridges will all be overprinted with purple indicators. And these 200,000 maps are also interesting because on the reverse side, they have geological diagrams and a written description of the topography and the geology, the physical landscapes. There's a long essay of, say, 3,000 words or something, and a geological diagram. And that's what's different about the 200,000 maps. Double the scale again, we're now on to 1 to 100,000. Now we're focusing in more onto northeast London. There are 144 of these to each grid square. So we're still in grid square M31. There'd be 144 of these 1 to 100,000 maps. And of course, because the scale is increased, then the amount of detail, the amount of information is increased. So this is M31-1, and this is described as being, it is classified now for official use. It's not secret, it's a classification less than secret, but for official use. I can't tell you exactly the significance of that classification, because these maps were all highly constrained in who would have access to them. Only the military would have access, but clearly the security classification would indicate what seniority, perhaps, or what special purpose would be needed to get use of one of these maps or to see one. Anyway, these are described as for official use, and its purpose would be described as tactical. And we haven't finished yet, because we're now getting onto the next scale, which is the largest scale we have of the topographic sheets of Britain. This is 1 to 50,000. Now, 1 to 50,000 is the same scale as your familiar Ordnance Survey Land Ranger map. So that's what this is. This is showing in a fair amount of detail, usable on the ground, usable for navigation on the ground, on foot. Here's northeast London at 1 to 50,000. And what's interesting about these, if we're thinking, well, where on earth did all this information come from? How are they doing 1 to 50,000 maps of London without, of course, teams of surveyors on the ground? Ordnance Survey could do this because they have surveyors. How did the Russians do it? And one, this map is dated 1981, and we only have the 50,000 sheets are only available for the southern part of England. Now, if you put those facts together, the Ordnance Survey, the first metric edition of the Ordnance Survey, 1 to 50,000, when they stopped using the one-inch to the mile maps, was about 1974. And this map says that it was compiled in 1974, although it was printed in 1981. So I think the assumption would be that they were able to produce metric maps of the south of England, the 1 to 50,000, following the arrival of metric. It seems too much of a coincidence that the Ordnance Survey 50,000 maps had just been produced. But it just leads us on to that question. Well, where did this information come from? And clearly, Ordnance Survey is a major source of information. But it isn't the only source of information. And Ordnance Survey had constraints. Ordnance Survey, on the right-hand side, if you were looking for secret sites in Britain, you might be worth looking at blank spaces on Ordnance Survey maps, because they were called redacted, is what they used, or security deletions. So the site we're looking at here is the Chatham Dockyard in Kent, the Royal Naval Dockyard at Chatham in Kent. And that was where, during the Cold War, the British submarines were being built. And the Ordnance Survey would regard that as a secret or a sensitive site, and it was a security deletion, it was redacted. So the Ordnance Survey map shows a blank space. The Russian map on the left doesn't copy what the Ordnance Survey do in this instance, and we'll see on the Russian map. Now, I admit these are different scales and different dates, but I'm just making the point here. So the British map is, in fact, a one-inch map. The Soviet map I'm showing is, in fact, 1 to 10,000, but I've enlarged them to make them look the same. However, the point being that the Soviet map of 1984 of Chatham shows the Royal Naval Dockyard, and it shows every building, every dock, the dry docks, the railway network, all the buildings, all the yards. So the fact that the Ordnance Survey deleted it was no hindrance to the Russian map makers. So in other words, the data they used was partly from Ordnance Survey, of course it would be, but it was also from many other sources. And a large part of our book is devoted to a sort of forensic study, really, of saying, well, looking at all the maps in detail and saying, where could this piece of information possibly have come from? And what we conclude is that, of course, you would have existing maps. Of course, you would have existing street maps, because streets are named, which they aren't on Ordnance Survey maps. Streets and districts are named on the Russian maps. They would have also the factories are shown, and factories are named. The factories are named, and their production of the factories is listed. So for that, you would need things like trade directories. Also, we would see many examples of new developments. Things that are not yet shown on an Ordnance Survey map are shown on a contemporary Russian map, often without names. So this is a very interesting example. This is Thornaby-on-Tees in the northeast of England. And there's two things to note about it. First of all, the housing development, the main road running north-south is the old A19, and the housing development on the left, there are no street names shown on that part. And that area is also not shown on current maps of the time because it's new housing developments. So the Russians clearly had used aerial photography, whether it's spy planes, whether it's satellites, but they would have good aerial imagery, and they're able to show very clearly the layout of that housing, even though we haven't yet put it on our maps. However, there is something here which is a massive giveaway, and it's this dotty line running right across from southeast to northwest. And that is shown as a proposed road. Now, if you're familiar with the geography of that area, there is no road running across there. There never has been a road. There never will be a road. So what are they up to? And in fact, in the 1980s, at the time of the exploitation of the North Sea gas and oil fields, a pipeline was built across northern England. And that is the excavation of that pipeline. So a Russian cartographer has got his aerial imagery, he's seen a long linear excavation, and he's reasonably enough said, they're building a road. We'll put a road on the map. It wasn't a road, it's a pipeline. So that, for us, is a very clear kind of fingerprint. That tells us that data came from aerial imagery. And really, what we've done in the book is looked at lots and lots of examples of where the data could have come from. And what we found was, in a way, absolutely fascinating, because clearly you can see what's come from aerial imagery. You can tell what might have come from trade directories, from street directories. But one other thing that we found quite fascinating was the different ages of Ordnance Survey maps that they must have had. Mm. So the Soviet maps have a lot of spot heights. So a little dot on the ground, and it will say the height here is 27 metres or something like that. And they're prolific all across the Soviet maps. And if you trace them back, they've all come from Ordnance Survey maps of the 1920s. 6-inch to the mile Ordnance Survey maps called the County Series, which were published in the 1920s, had spot heights everywhere, and they had the value of those heights as at the latest survey in the 1920s. Later maps, Ordnance Survey maps later than that, published in the 1930s, 40s, and right through to the late 20th century, from time to time they drop off. They keep dropping these off. They have far fewer heights, and those they do have often have a new value because there's been a new survey. But the Russian map almost always traces back to those earlier ones. So we can say, well, actually, they didn't just go to Stanford's and collect the latest Ordnance Survey map, which would have been easy to do. They must have been squirreling these maps away for years, collecting old maps. And we saw that again with place names, where I've already said they have Cyrillic versions, but different ages of maps. So a district name, for example, is not definitive. An area is people use different, slightly different meaning for an area. And so street maps of cities will sometimes show the same place name in slightly different places. And the Russian map, you can often tell which map they've used for this place because that's where they've put the name. Or they've even put the name twice on the map because they've found different maps have got this same place name. There's a lovely example in Bradford where a name Cole Place is twice about half a mile apart on the Russian map. And you can see that there's one British map had it there, the other British map had it here. The cartographers simply put both. So that's really what the book is all about. And we've quickly taken you through the story, but we're very happy now to answer your questions, which really the most interesting part of the talk is to have your questions and to hear your and to discuss this with you.
Yeah. Great.
Okay, though. I think
I forgot I had a mic. I think he would love it. I think he would. I don't know what you would think.
President Trump would say fake history. Yeah, President Putin would probably say,
real
"Well
history.
Done."
I mean, the point we've taken really is this is a real celebration of the achievement of Soviet cartography, and if anything, I hope he would be proud of the fact that we are saying, "Look, this is what you achieved. This is what the Soviet Union has achieved." And even though, of course, we'll find there will always be these quirky mistakes that make us laugh, it is still quite astounding to think that thousands of miles away, you've got cartographers that are working on materials in different languages that they just wouldn't understand perhaps what the actual situation was on the ground, and yet they're able to come up with something amazing and very reliable. So I think he would be quite proud, but let's see.
Yeah. Sorry, I can't.
Yeah.
Okay. Very. Yeah.
Interesting story.
Yeah. During the Soviet time, of the Soviet Union, these maps were printed in factories across the Soviet Union, and they were stored in depots also across the Soviet Union. There were probably about a dozen factories and probably about 20 or 30 depots where they were stored. And the idea being that a local commander from anywhere in the Soviet Union could be sent to his local depot, he could be told to collect maps of London because you're going to go on mission to London tomorrow. So that's where they were all across the Soviet Union. One of those depots happened to be in Latvia, a town called Sasis in eastern Latvia. And in that depot were stored the maps for local use. It was, of course, secret. Only local people, only the military would know. However, the collapse of the Soviet Union happened so quickly that in Latvia and probably in other places, this depot was effectively stranded. It was there in an independent country. And the details are a bit hazy about how these maps got liberated from the depot. But local orienteers knew about the maps and must have formed some collaboration with the people who were responsible for the maps. And so local people did get to know about them. The Soviet army had to vacate very quickly and were keen to destroy their maps. And a local smart guy offered to buy them as waste paper, which is what he did. So they were bought as waste paper. That satisfied the Russians, who didn't have to then cart them all the way back to Moscow. Mm-hmm. And the smart guy who bought them as waste paper was a keen orienteer who also founded a map shop in Riga. And so, although many of them were then destroyed by vandals, a lot of them did end up in the shop in Riga, which is where I first found them, and they continue to sell them in that shop, the original paper maps. Mm. We've put on our website, we've loaded many, many of these maps, and we'll continue to load more. It's a bit of a slow process. We've so far loaded up about 100 of these maps, because the book, of course, is only that size and only has extracts. The maps are huge. Yeah. The city plans, particularly, they're more a meter by meter, typically, on good quality paper, very good quality printing. So we've digitized them and putting them on the website.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we can't hear.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, that's also a very interesting question. I suppose the key difference is the sheer resources that the Soviet Union had to complete this project. So we've done some comparisons, for example, with the US NEMA maps, which the National Intelligence Imagery Agency, that were producing maps at the same time for cities where the US had strategic interest, for example. But they're nowhere near, think about the city plans, nowhere near the amount of detail in terms of the terrain, for example, or even the streets, or even actually the classification of buildings. It's not that level of detail. So I think where you had a comparison between, let's say, NATO and the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union's approach was much more comprehensive in terms of remapping everything, and NATO would have focused those resources very carefully on what they thought was of strategic interest, for example. I mean, there are other initiatives like the International Map of the World that we might talk about, but that was only at 1 to 1 million scale, and here the Soviet Union was mapping at several scales, going right down to 50,000 for a topographic map. So a huge amount of maps, if you like, millions, really, millions of sheets. And I guess also it brings out another point as to why, you know, why bother making these maps and going to that amount of detail. And I think the conclusion that we would really come to is that the paper maps were used as a sort of repository for all sorts of information. Whatever could be known about a place was put on the map. So it wasn't a case of focusing just on what was maybe relevant at that particular time, but, for example, features like disused railways, tramways, where long after the railways would have been closed down, mines and so on, they would still be on the map. So it's as if they were trying to sort of put everything together. And we sort of think maybe it's a little bit like a sort of Cold War Wikipedia in a way. Let's just put everything we can, everything that's knowable in terms of the geography about the place, let's put it on the map. And then who knows, it could be used for lots of different purposes. But I think also, given that, you know, we're looking at this as a global project, as you said at the beginning about different countries, the Soviet Union at the start, thinking about when the project was initiated, the idea was that global domination, basically, this being a global communism project. So the idea that the cartographers perhaps were mapping for the future, when the world would one day be communist, and then that idea continues because it's such a, well, in a way, it's sort of such a snowball. You sort of map different places around the world to a single specification and continue that project because it supports the interests of the state, however the changes of leadership happen over that time. So, yeah, it's a very interesting question. I think only the Soviet Union could have done it. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yeah, well, sorry, yeah. Can you hear me?
Question from the other government.
Yeah.
Did you ask official comment from the Russian embassy or did you have any input unofficially from other former Russian military people to explain or comment? If not, why?
Yeah. I mean, there's the Moscow conference. Do you want to talk about that? It's a good question.
Yeah. Engaging with the Russian authorities, we felt was not the right thing to do. These maps are freely available. We're free to write about them, and that's the approach we've taken. Russia would want to put some hindrance in our way, and we'd prefer to avoid that. That's the simple answer to the question.
I think it might also be worth... I was just going to say about a conference that we went to, a history of cartography conference in Moscow in 2011, where we presented our work at an international history of cartography conference that was held in the Lenin Library opposite the Kremlin. Our idea being, of course, we wanted to tell everyone about this fantastic project, but also to be open and say, well, okay, if there's something that can emerge from the other side, let's say the Iron Curtain, then we are open to hear. But as we might have expected, we didn't really get anyone wanting to come and engage for one reason or another, but the invitation and the offer was there to have that. So, yeah, we were there to be approached.
I noticed that your red dots included Soviet bloc,
Bulgaria,
and also included the states which were in the Soviet Union. There were no red dots in Russia itself. They were mapping Eastern Bloc,
I think.
There were two organisations which were very closely connected. Yeah. The military topographic were called VTU, and there was a sister organisation called GUGK, and their remit was effectively civil mapping. But in fact, the two they're very, very similar, and the maps are very, very similar. And GUGK did map the entire Soviet Union at 1 to 10,000. So they had their topographic maps right across the Soviet Union, including Latvia, and, well, the whole thing, and the city plans. But there's a very clear distinction between the two in that the military maps, who also covered that same area, showed latitude and longitude. They showed coordinates and they were numbered in accordance with that system that I showed you. So 037 or 035 or something would tell you that that square was Riga and all the other map that larger scales would fit within that. So for the civil series, which they did in parallel, there was a different numbering system which was far more random, so you couldn't tell where the map was off from the number, and the maps themselves did not have any coordinates. They were also slightly distorted. So they were of use to civil authorities, so the Highways Authority and everybody else could, but only officials. They were not available. They're not in the public domain. They were never available to the general public, who only ever had diagrams or sketch map kind of things. Yeah. So this civil series were distorted. They were stripped of any identity as to where they were, but they were still useful for the civil authorities. And that system applied right across the whole of the Warsaw Pact. East Germans, the Poles, everybody did the same thing. A military series and a civil series. And today, the large-scale maps of Russia are actually very, very difficult to get. Russia does not allow them outside. So although these, the Russia know perfectly well that the Latvians have got all these maps of the rest of the world, but the Latvians have not got maps of modern-day Russia. They just cannot get them. So even smuggled out, they're very hard to get. But so former Soviet Union, okay, but current Russia, no.
Yeah. I think also just the other side of that story is that what we are showing and what we are mapping is, of course, only what we know and what we know to exist. And I think, you know, as John's saying, you have these different organisations, but, you know, we have seen a handful of Russian cities that have been mapped, of course, using similar specifications, but it's a different programme, if you like, in terms of how you map foreign territories compared to your home territory. And I guess there are different... obviously different reasons for that, but just to give you an idea from what John was saying about the scales, of course, if you're talking about city plans that are 1 to 25,000, 1 to 10,000, these are very large-scale maps. When I was doing some research years ago, looking at topographic maps of 1 to 50,000, I asked Russia for a sample, and they could only send me a 1 to 200,000 scale map, quoting the fact that that's the largest scale that they will allow out of the country. That's current mapping, but I dare say, looking retrospectively, it also applies for the larger scale stuff as well. So that would probably explain the gap, if you like, into what you've seen. It's only what we know exists, but we would say yes, it's bound to.
Yeah, we don't know what we don't know.
We don't know, yeah.
Is also very true. So we've shown maps of 100 different British cities. There must have been a lot more. Yeah. It's very frustrating to us. So we don't know of a map of Kingston upon Hull, for example, or Carlisle, or Limerick. You know, large, significant places. We can't find a map, but there must have been them, because we've got plenty of maps of Dunfermline and Gainsborough and Kilmarnock. So, you know, there must have been a lot more maps. And the frustrating thing for us in telling a story like this is we have no idea what we don't know. Yeah. And maybe it will never be known. We've only got these few little treasures which survived the Vandals, which survived the destruction of the maps in this depot in Latvia. So from that slender evidence, we've told a story. We'd love to know more. You know, part of, as Alex said, we went to Moscow to try and find out more, and we were just stonewalled. So I guess you're never going to know. And the people who took part in this project are people who are now obviously long retired. You know, so that you're not going to speak to the cartographers. They died or retired, and they would have taken the secrets to the grave. So we're not. I don't think we're going to know. Maybe archives will get opened in 50 years' time. Maybe not. So for the right now, the best information we've got is in the book. Hopefully, in a few years, we may get more.
Yeah.
We're probably running out of time. One or two more questions.
Have you heard from anybody involved in creating these maps? And have you heard perhaps from anybody who has found
them
in any way useful?
Yes. Well, the first answer is no. The first part of that, sadly, as John's saying, it's very difficult. I mean, it would be a dream to be able to talk to someone who's involved. I mean, one of the interesting things, if you have a look at some of the earlier maps, for example, certainly the city plans, right in the bottom right-hand corner, you've got a code that will tell you when the map was printed, where it was printed, the map factory. And just below that, sometimes it'll tell you the sources. And even then, sometimes as well, it'll tell you who was responsible for creating. You have a name or two. the editors, for example. And quite a lot of those are women, funny enough, as well. It's very interesting. So, again, you get a sense of the maybe the personal connection that there was, well, there were people behind these maps, of course. They're not just the product of a machine or a blankless sort of ideal. But, on the other hand, you know, very difficult to make those contacts today, I think. In terms of use, I know John's got some really good examples as well. I mean, a couple I remember, for example, in Afghanistan, much more recently, 2001, the US pilots, for example, using the Soviet topographic maps because they were the most detailed mapping they had available of the terrain at that time. And again, for a lot of places around the world, these do present the latest accurate geospatial information. So certainly, they've got a lot of uses beyond, you know, what we currently know today. Another one, another purpose, looking at the city plans. I don't know, we had the image there of Chatham, where you have the military areas, for example, blanked out on Ordnance Survey maps. There are some environmental consultancies in the UK that use the Soviet plans to get a clue as to what used to exist before, obviously, the OS maps today, because sometimes this information is deleted and you can't see it. So that level of detail, very useful for environmental information as well. But I know you have some more examples, don't you, as well, Jonathan? Did you want to say any more? You have a couple of examples, I think, from New Zealand.
Yeah, there was a story about our work. It went out on Wired.com, which is read around the world. They had a map blog or something like that. Several people contacted us as a result of that, saying, oh, you know, interested to hear what you're doing. We use these maps in such and such. One of them that sticks in my mind is the United Nations peacekeeping force, humanitarian peacekeepers on the Israel-Lebanon borders were using the Russian maps because they were the only thing that showed the borders. So in lots of cases, we've quoted them in the book. The New Zealand Army going into Afghanistan had no better maps, and so on. So it's very interesting to us that these maps have been these were talking about small scale, the topographic maps, which are the only mapping, still the only mapping. Oil exploration in India and Pakistan, oil explorers have used the Russian maps.
Incidentally,
I would just tell you last thing. Yeah. We have digitized a lot of these maps, and we're slowly putting them on the website, but we'll also be able to sell prints of them. So if anybody is interested in acquiring prints of the maps, if you email that address, we'll let you know as soon as they're available. But it's going to take us another few weeks before we've got the website fully functioning. But for those British ones particularly, which I think are absolutely fascinating maps, we've digitized them and we will make prints available. Call us on that number, address.
Just one more thing as well on that as well, especially the British example. Something that we're really keen to know, of course, is where we can use local knowledge. So, for example, if you look at the list of maps and you say, well, I'm from Bradford, I'm from Dover, you know, whatever, obviously the chances are you know those cities and towns and you'll be able to look at the Soviet map and say, oh, that's interesting, why did they map this in this particular way? I thought they would have this and they haven't had that. In Dover, near where I live, for example, there was an aerial cableway that came through the cliff so that you could drop coal basically onto the ships in the harbour so that then they obviously could sail off. That level of detail is obviously very, very local to Dover. And again, there's a huge use here, really, a huge application for local history. So really, that's something that we're trying to encourage as well, to understand from people that know these different places, of course, some of these quirks and interesting things about the maps themselves, because they are a fascinating resource in that sort of way as well. And
okay, I think we're done.
You're done, thank you.